Would you say that you find it harder being a Christian, behaving as a Christian, when you're within the church community, or when you're outside of the church community, when you're sort of in the world, if we use that as a bit of a shorthand? Sometimes when we're within the church community, it's easy for us to relax. Whereas when we're in the world, some of us will be increasingly sharpened up by the challenge that we find there. Which is true for you? Do you find it easier, more easy within, or easier without? Now, James has spent some time dealing with the church community. So have a look, 3:13, who is wise and understanding among you? 4:1, what causes quarrels and fights among you? 4:11, don't speak evil against one another. And what he's been showing us is how our double-mindedness, the way in which we import the world standards to church life, have such a detrimental effect on the life of the Christian community. And what he's called us to do within that community is to live by the implanted word that we saw in chapter 1 was the word that was able to save us. Now, and quite briefly, James turns his attention from the church community and our lives there to our lives outside of that community. How do we conduct ourselves in our workplaces, in our businesses? What about our attitude towards time and money and our employees, those who depend upon us? And what James is going to say is that it's not acceptable for us as Christian believers to say, well, out there, I'm going to behave by the world's own standards. After all, that's where I am. We know what happens there. We know the standards people live by. I'll just adopt those for the moment while I'm there. But as we'll know, if you've been around Christian circles any length of time, James, along with Paul, will say, it doesn't matter where you are, within the church or without, doesn't matter what you're doing, taking part in your small group, or sitting at your desk in your office, you're still there to serve the Lord Jesus. You're still there to live up to the standards that he has given to you. You serve him in that situation with those people, regardless of where or when that is. Now, obviously, when we're out and about in the world, the voices that we're listening to and the influences coming to bear upon us are those of the world. We're living, working, relaxing amongst people who don't know Jesus, the Lord of glory, the King of all, as the Christian community does. Consequently, the pressures and the opportunities to follow the world's way are going to be all the greater, aren't they? After all, everyone else is doing it. It's just the culture of the firm or the business sector. It's what is expected. And James is saying to us that our battle against double-mindedness in our lives in the world is no less important than it is within the church community. Now, these two paragraphs, I am assuming, are both written to Christian believers within the congregations that James is writing to. You may have been rather sort of struck by the strength of language, particularly in the second of the two paragraphs. But just glance back to verse 1 of chapter 4. Because those of you who were here last time will remember James used particularly strong language about the church community there. What causes quarrels? What causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? You desire and don't you have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. That's how James writes to the church community. That's how he writes to Christians. So therefore, to use a lot of that language again in this section seems to me to say, yes, that's James is quite comfortable to use that language, the Christian community. He's not going to sort of fudge it. He's not going to pretend somehow all is well. So these paragraphs are written to the Christian community. Let's have the first quotation up, please, Matthew. Both paragraphs, one commentary said, rebuke the attitude of well-to-do people who arrogantly suppose that they can think and act without reference to God and to eternity. Arrogant selfishness is the problem. Arrogant selfishness. Thinking we know best. Thinking we're in charge. That's the battle we have. That's the challenge we have to face as we take on our double-mindedness in relation to time and work and wealth and self-importance. How easily we adopt the standards of those amongst whom we're living and working. How easily we forget our sovereign God. How easily we forget there is a judgment day coming. Thanks, Matthew. You can take that down now. First of all then, verses 13 to 17, arrogant planning ignores God's providence. Arrogant planning ignores God's providence. The problem, what's at stake here, is their boasting, not their business. Nowhere is James saying business is wrong. Nowhere is James saying capitalism is wrong. The problem is their boasting, not their business. He spells out in verses 13 to 15 how they're behaving and what they're doing. The reason is verse 16. So go down to verse 16. As it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Now, some of those who are part of these Christian communities who've been driven out of Jerusalem, if that's a right understanding of what's going on here, they are business people. They travel. They trade. They make a profit. And consequently, they share many of the characteristics and attitudes of their non-Christian colleagues and competitors. This is the world they're operating in. These are the people they're working with and against. Therefore, their minds are going to be shaped by the same sort of thinking. And at root is this boasting of verse 16. This arrogance, this pride of life which says, I'm in charge. Which says, I am self-sufficient. I can manage on my own. Let's have the next slide up, please, Matthew. And that verse 14 tempts them to think that they know everything. James says, yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. Tomorrow is a foreign country, isn't it? The very existence of tomorrow tells me I'm not in charge. Now, as you're sitting here, you've got a pretty good idea of what you're going to be doing tomorrow, haven't you? Your diaries are telling you what you're going to be doing tomorrow. You've got meetings, you've got trains to catch, and all the rest of it. But we all know it doesn't take much to completely disrupt those plans, does it? Maybe we'll wake up tomorrow morning with Jono's man flu. That'll be it. You'll be in bed for weeks. He's so brave. Maybe we'll get a phone call about a sick relative that you've got to go and deal with. Maybe the person that you're supposed to be meeting won't be able to do that. That's how we live our lives, isn't it? None of us knows what will happen tomorrow. We've seen some tragic interviews in the media this week, haven't we? Parents who sent their children off to school in Florida. expecting that as normal they would come home that afternoon or evening. None of us knows what is just around the corner. So we don't know about tomorrow. But this boastfulness also tempts us to think we're more important than we are, to tempt us to think that there is a permanence about us. You can take that away now, Matthew, thank you. Yet you don't know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. There's nothing permanent here, is there? We are just here today and gone tomorrow. We're barely a speck of dust on the timeline. James' image here is that of mist or smoke, burnt off by the sun, blown away by the breeze. There's nothing substantial about it at all. That's how we should view our lives. That's how we should challenge our self-importance. Put the Revelation quotation up, Matthew, please. In Revelation, in chapter 18, merchants are bewailing the end of, well, we might say capitalism, the end of their system, the end of their way of going about things. And here's just a couple of quotations. The merchants of the earth weep and mourn for her, it's for Babylon, since no one buys their cargo anymore. The system's broken. The merchants of these wares who gained wealth from her will stand far off in fear of her torment, weeping and mourning aloud. This is the reality. This is the end point when we get above ourselves, either in thinking we're here for too long or for thinking we're more important than we really are. Thanks, Matthew. Our attitude, rather, should be that of verse 15. Instead, James says, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. That is the answer to the question of verse 13. Today or tomorrow, we will go into such a place, we'll spend a year, trade and make a profit. Instead, that's what you should be saying. That's what you should be reminding yourself on all the time. Because yes, there is one who is in control. There is one who does know about tomorrow. There is one who is eternal. And he is this Lord. Now, the interesting thing is that many first century sort of businessy type documents have been found. And they have the phrase, if God wills, this transaction, this deal will go through. Interestingly, James has changed it. He's made it more Christian. He's changed it from God to the Lord. You see, we're to remember who's in charge. We're to remember verse 5 of chapter 4. God yearns jealously over the spirit he's made to dwell in us. That there is one who has given life to us all. He is the one who is in charge of everything. Now, of course, we have to be careful, don't we? We could just use verse 15 as a bit of a mantra, couldn't we? We could just say, if the Lord wills. And I've certainly been in church circles where I've heard people say, church notices, well, this is going to happen, that's going to happen, and people just say sort of DV. Now, some of you know what DV means, won't you? It means Deo Volente. It means if the Lord wills. And it becomes a bit of a mantra, a bit of a sort of magic phrase that is meant to make everything okay. Well, that's not what James is talking about here at all. He's talking about an attitude. John Calvin, yes, have the next one up, Matthew, please. John Calvin puts it like this. I hope he does anyway. Has Matthew fallen asleep? You've fallen asleep, Matthew. Brilliant. John Calvin put it like this. Servants of God had it as a principle fixed in their minds that they could do nothing without the permission of God. Total and utter dependence upon him in every situation and for everything. And that's what the double-minded Christian will forget. We plan without him. And that's what verse 17 is saying. Just turn over to verse 17. This is a sin of omission. Sins of commission is doing stuff wrong. Sins of omission is not doing stuff we should be doing, not remembering stuff we should be remembering. All such boasting is evil, so whoever knows the right thing to do, submit to God. James has said that a number of times previously, and fails to do it, for him it is sin. In all of your life, in all of your actions, you must acknowledge the one who is in charge. Matthew, you can get rid of that now. So let's be clear, James isn't saying don't plan. James isn't saying don't plan. He's not saying that to us individually or corporately. He says, don't plan thinking you're in charge. Don't plan thinking everything depends upon you. In all of our planning, there must be a sense of contingency. There must be a willingness to recognize that plans may need to change. And so, what that looks like for us is a commitment to pray, a commitment to go on seeking the Lord in all of our planning. Now, we had a church council meeting on Monday night. And at the church council, we were discussing future staffing needs here at St. John's. Planning for that sort of thing is exactly the right thing to do, and it's what the PCC should be doing, as long as our attitude is right. And at the start of our meeting, as we looked at some Bible together, Giles brought us back to exactly that point. But the same goes for our personal lives. Having a pension, buying some life assurance, that's absolutely fine. Preparing to go to university, getting ready for retirement, exactly what we should be doing. As long as our attitude is right. As long as we remember that the future is in his hands and not mine. And as long as we submit to him as the sovereign Lord of all. Let's turn over the page then to the beginning of chapter 5. Misusing wealth and power brings God's judgment. Misusing wealth and power brings God's judgment. And as we said with the previous section, so here, the problem, what's at stake, is not wealth itself. It never is in the New Testament. What is a problem is the attitude surrounding wealth. James uses the same introduction. Did you notice that? Come now. His previous general introductions to his teaching has been brothers. But he changes that. This bit sort of quite peremptory, quite sharp. Come now. Same in the previous paragraph and here too. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. He's condemning the rich, not because they're rich, but because they've gained their riches through defrauding others, they've hoarded their wealth, they've lived lives of luxury, and they've oppressed others. We'll come to those in a moment. But look at verses sort of 1 to 3. Weep and howl, for the miseries are coming on. Your riches have rotted, your garments are moth-eaten, your gold and silver have corroded, and their corrosion will be evidence against you, and will eat your flesh like fire. You've laid up treasure in the last days. Short, sharp phrases, which are drawn from the Old Testament prophets, as they condemned God's people for similar offences. Let's have Luke 6, Matthew, please. This is what Jesus says in Luke 6. But woe to you who are rich, for you've received your consolation. Woe to you who are full now, for you shall be hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, for you shall mourn and weep. Again, James is picking up some of that language as well, isn't he? And the Proverbs quote's interesting because there are a number of places in the Old Testament and the New where the rich and the unrighteous are associated. The wage of the righteous leads to life, the gain of the wicked to sin. But what I want you to notice, as with the previous section, James's focus of attention here is on the transience of these things. Okay, Matthew, you can take that away. Thank you. So, we've got riches that have rotted, we've got garments that are moth-eaten, and we've got gold and silver have corroded. Interestingly, the word for corroded there is the word for rust. But, as you will know, gold and silver don't rust, do they? It's a picture. James is picking it up from other pre-Christian writings. The point being, all wealth is doomed. All wealth will pass away. Don't put your trust in it. It can't provide you anything trustworthily for the present, and it can provide you no foundation for the future. All wealth is doomed. Jesus, on the other hand, Matthew, let's have the final quotation up. Jesus rather shows us how it should be. Sell your possessions and give to the needy. In other words, do good with your wealth. Provide yourselves with money bags that don't grow old, with a treasure in the heavens that does not fail, where no thief approaches and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. In other words, in the present world, use your riches, your wealth, to do good. But make sure you're storing up treasures in heaven. Make sure your true investment is in those things which have spiritual value. Give your time, your attention, your abilities, your efforts, and your money not to material comforts and ease, but rather to storing up treasure in heaven. Those to whom James writes face various accusations. Verse 4, they've defrauded their workers. You've kept back their wages, and they're crying out against you. Verse 5, their lifestyle is that of self-indulgence. You've lived on earth in luxury and in self-indulgence. And notice the on the earth, almost certainly a contrast there with what is demanded of us in eternity. And fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. The picture there is of the animal being fattened up before it goes to the slaughterhouse. There's only one outcome, in other words. The final accusation, verse 6, we get the murder thing again here, don't we? You've condemned and you've murdered the righteous person. He does not resist you. The condemned word is used of a sort of judicial setting, a courtroom setting. And so what James may well have in mind, he may have a specific case in mind, is where the rich, the wealthy have taken a poor person to court, and they have won their case, but as a result of which the poor person and his family have fallen into destitute circumstances and may even have died as a result. And that sort of behavior, again, in pre-Christian literature, is often described as murder. Now, of course, there's a challenge here. Okay, Matthew, you can take that away. Thanks. There's a challenge here to all of us as to how we have acquired our wealth. There's a challenge here to all of us as to how we treat others in our pursuit of and use of wealth. It's often been said that we must be generous to people on the way up, because we may well need their help on the way down. But again, the main challenge here is the challenge of eternity and the coming judgment. Wealth is transitory. So while we can, let's use it for God-honoring and gospel-extending purposes. Don't give your time and effort and energies to gaining more wealth on earth. These are the last days, And the one thing that must happen, according to Jesus and the Gospels and the New Testament writers in these last days, is that the good news of Jesus must go out to the ends of the earth. That's what we're to be committed to, individually and corporately. So you might just like to ponder how you need to change your priorities to reflect Jesus' priorities in these days. Now, if you're sitting here as parents this evening, one of the very interesting ways in which the true intentions of your heart will be revealed and your true motivations shown is what you're hoping and wanting and desiring for your children. Is it their material prosperity and comfort? Is it their educational success? Is it their future marriage, partner, children, family? Or is it their spiritual well-being? Is it they come to know and love and serve the Lord Jesus? Which of those is uppermost in your thoughts? When you're talking to friends or others about the children, what are the things you talk about? I'm very conscious that at the moment, both of our children are without jobs. And both of our children are without Jesus. I think I talk more about them being without jobs than without Jesus. And I'm challenged by that thought in the light of this. I've got to do something more about that. Just glance down to verse 7 as we close. Be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. Whatever our present circumstances, whether we consider ourselves wealthy or rich, whether we consider ourselves as those who have status or are oppressed, whatever stage of life we're at, whatever hopes and expectations we're seeking to fulfill, James says, be patient until the coming of the Lord. That is the day that matters. And you need to live in the light of that day. And you need to invest in the light of that day. That's true of your money, as we've seen here. That's true of your time and this fleeting life you've been given, as we saw in the previous section. And if that is your perspective, that will mark you out from your non-Christian friends, family. If that is your perspective, it'll save you from being double-minded. May we know the reality of Jesus' return as judge. And may we serve him wholeheartedly as we look forward to that day.